Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are 2/4 of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another episode of Never Thought I'd Say This. I'm your host, Jody Sweeten, and I'm joined by the amazing, fabulous, and wonderful Celia Behar. Hi,
aww,
Celia.
Hi. You're just being nice to me because you know I had a messed up weekend. That's all.
No, I'm always nice to you.
What?
I know. I know. Everyone listening is like, no, you're,
no,
not.
You're not. No, no, you're not. That's not true. Of course you are.
Right. Anyway, you know I love you. I'd hug you right now, but you'd get uncomfortable and weird. Yeah, don't do that.
No.
So we have a guest today.
We do, but I have a little story before we get into this.
Oh, okay.
Which also sort of sets the mood for the show and just haphazardness of the show in general, because it's like the haphazardness of my life.
Okay.
We've talked about self-care on the show.
Right.
And how I've said one of the things I do for self-care, which I've never done before in my life, is have a cleaning service come in.
Right.
We actually have the same cleaning people.
Right.
You and I.
I'm not kidding. That is the best money that
gift
I spend every month.
Absolutely.
It really helps.
It really helps. And I don't have time, right?
Yeah.
So every time they come, I go and hang out in the back of my house.
Right.
And I wave at them and I'm like, yeah. And then they always open the door and they're like, we're done. I'm like, great, thank you so much. They leave. Great.
Right.
Okay. So that they came on Thursday.
Right.
Friday, after I got the kids off to school.
Okay.
It was the weekend of the anniversary of my sister's passing. So I was already kind of, you know, fragile.
Right.
And I'm out hanging out in the backyard and I'm like, oh, it's really quiet. It's weird. Maybe they're done. And I go to go inside and they have locked me out of my house. So let me just say this. I'm dressed for yoga because usually I'm like yoga right after when they leave. And most people know I wear these like ridiculous yoga pants.
Yes, you do.
I was wearing Cats Eating Cheeseburgers. Luckily, I had my keys for my house in my outside with me.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't matter because all of the gates around my house lock from the outside so that nobody can get in. So I am trapped in the backyard of my house. I can't go anywhere. There is a padlock on the door of the outside of my gate. So I'm like, I'm going to have to just like hoist my shit up here and figure out.
Boy.
Broke a table trying to do it.
Oh my God.
And then I like had to throw one leg over and like try to just unlock the gate. Cause I'm also like, I'm going to fall on my ass if I go all the way over.
Right.
So I had to, I'm over the gate like a horse, unlocking the gate. And of course, I look up and there are the neighbors I've never met before. And I'm like straddling the gate. Both of them are just on their porch, like looking at me. And they're like,
hey,
are you okay? And I was like, I'm good. Hi. And the woman's like,
live there?
No, she knew I did. But she goes, I know this is like a weird question to ask you at this very moment, other than like, do you need any help? I was like, no, I'm good. And she goes, do you have cats eating cheeseburgers on your leggings?
Like, yes, actually, I
was like, I do. Nice to meet you. Okay, bye-bye. And like slunk off of the thing after I unlocked it.
All I'm hoping for, do you have an outdoor security camera?
Because I do, but not right there.
Oh, damn it. I really wish we could see that.
I was so bummed. So I broke a nail and then I decided, I think you texted me. I was like, I'm going to go get my nails done tonight as self-care because my other self-care ended up being a disaster. That was what the disaster was.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's talent.
It was something.
To get locked in your own backyard.
In my own backyard. Couldn't get the fuck out. Came home, made myself dinner after my nails, got a book, read a nice book, relaxed, calmed my shit down.
I have several books that are on my list to read, and I think I'm actually going to start making myself get back to read. Like, I read the news on my phone. I read, but like, I miss reading, and I just haven't had the time lately. I've been working like crazy, so I'm really excited to get back to reading. And today's guest is award-winning freelance journalist and author Jason Sheehan. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Well, we're not locked in our backyard, and
that was impressive. I was also hoping there was going to be a Ring camera end to that story.
Right? I wish.
I know. I mean, I feel like I need to put a security cam back there, right in that spot, just in case I ever have to do that again.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, Jason, you are a book and video game critic for NPR. You've published 3 books for adults, and Children of the Flying City, which was released last month, is your first book for young adults. So thank you so much for joining us. Really excited to talk to you. Also, I'm a huge NPR fan, so
yay. Same here.
I've hit the age now where, like, the kids get out of the car and I switch it to NPR. That happened the other day where I was like, oh, God, enough of this noise. And I put it on NPR and I went,
The second Terry Gross starts talking, how can you not relax?
Yeah.
You know,
like,
what I mean?
Everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, you're all right.
But I'm also now really, really 40.
God,
that's
40.
I remember my mom listening to like NPR and talk radio and being like, it's so ridiculous. Who does that? Oh, my God. It's so lame and so old. And now I'm like, I need to be informed. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
I used to make the kids listen to it in the car all the time. It was the only thing I had on in the car for the longest. I mean, years and years and years and years and years until I got XM radio. And now I listen to the grunge station and make them listen to that.
Right.
Nice.
Yes.
They're probably into that. How old are your kids? What are your parenting stats, as we say?
Parker is 18. And Maddox is 11.
Ah.
Well, I have a 10-year-old. She's an 11-year-old. And God.
And an almost 14-year-old. 11, almost 14. She will be 14 tomorrow, April 12th.
Wow.
Nice.
Wow.
It's terrifying. She's 5'9". She's
dropped
looks
in
like,
gorgeous.
Yeah, she's an adult, basically. And I feel really inept on a daily basis of like, oh, I didn't read the manual on what to do now.
Seriously, after they get past like 12, 13 years old, yeah, that's, I would wish there were a manual, but she is just, we're going through all the like the college stuff now.
Oh, and God, right.
Visits
right.
And all that stuff. And it's remarkable to me how entirely she can ignore volumes of advice and, you know, and everything from her parents who, you know, had to go through that and went and did with the applying and the everything else, and then gets on her computer in like 3 clicks and a 500 word essay and she's like, okay, done, and then leaves us to just stress and fret and track applications and this stuff coming in. And I can't imagine if we had had what she has now when my wife and I were like 18 years old and waiting to hear back from colleges, like literally like looking at the mailbox and waiting for the mailman to come with a physical letter telling us what we had. And that's all you can do. That's all you can do is sit there and wait. And now, like, you know, like we can just click refresh on the email like every 35 seconds, you know, to see whether or not she's gotten an update on her portal for the various colleges.
Exactly. My daughter just had to apply for high schools because she is going to a private school. My younger one's in public school, my older one's in private school. And we had to do the high school applications, which I was like, I don't really give a shit if you go to private school. But I know that's what she wanted.
You have to do applications for high school no matter what you do.
Well,
anyway,
I know. Here. It was ridiculous. I didn't have to do that as a kid. It was like you just showed up and school was there. And that was it. And what else did you have to do?
Yeah, my daughter picked a major for high school. Bonkers to me. I mean, it was fascinating. Like looking, looking at a college course catalog. But and she picked art because that's useful. That'll serve her well in the future, I'm sure.
I think.
Look, I mean,
detect some sarcasm there.
It's fine because now that she's going to college, she wants to go and become a teacher. So that's awesome.
Oh,
and
that's great. That's
great. Yeah. But yeah, it was there was that moment with having creatives as parents, and she says, "I'm going to be an art major in high school." I'm like, "Oh God, we failed again!"
Oh my God!
No, you didn't.
I have a 15-year-old, and she is a zoology major in high school, and she wants to be a zoologist. And the other day, out of nowhere, she came out with like, I don't know, maybe I want to go to school for like music, and stuff, and try to be like a writer or a journalist. And I was like,
No.
No, just you just shut like, that shit down.
Look, like, let's be real.
Like they need zoologists more. They need zoologists more. Get a
I'm gonna go with good journalism is a necessity, particularly in the times right now.
He's been it's not a fun career.
I know.
It is absolutely a necessity for all of us. It's just a terrible thing for the person who has to do the journalism.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm an actor, right. So what the fuck do I know about, you know, picking stable and careers?
Exactly. It's, you know, I was like, I have an undergrad in acting. I was like, science, they want save an animal. Like, that's all I could.
No one
and I was trying to be
shit
so,
about your major.
I know, but when it's a zoologist, if you're going to go to school and learn all those things, I was like, save animals and then write about the animals that you're saving as a journalist for like National Geographic, and then you can write a song about it. you can combine it all.
Here's what I say. I didn't figure out my life until about 30 minutes ago. So, you know, and I'm still a little iffy on things. So I'm kind of like, whatever. I just do some, just complete fucking high school. Like, that's really my goal at this point is like, just do that.
And if you want to do college, cool. And if you can finish college, cool. But we sort of the same thing. No one is ever going to ask you what your major was. No one is ever going to care where you went to school.
No.
Unless they're doing a behind the music on you. It's just none of this is going to matter. And I'm the same way. I was a cook. You know, I went to college a couple different times for a couple different years. I never graduated. I was a line cook and then a chef for years. And that's how I ended up a journalist and a children's author.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense.
Right.
Unless you're going to become a scientist of some kind, I do actually question, you know, a therapist, like something that you really need a license and training for. I do wonder if college is worth it sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, a teacher, you need it. If you're going to become a plumber or fix car, like that, you need like, you know, a
trade certification. Super important. We don't have enough trade school people. We, you know, go to community college for a couple years, figure it out. Don't put yourself in $200,000 worth of debt and
gap year it, man.
Figure out what it is you want to do.
Statistically, trade school people make more money.
Yeah, trade school people do make more money. Yeah.
My niece Ariana is about to graduate from high school and told me the other day she's going to trade school. She's becoming a carpenter and a welder.
Which is amazing.
And I was like, that is the coolest thing.
And being a female in those types of trades is really, really a necessity.
Yeah.
So that's amazing.
I'm super psyched.
Yeah. My fiance was an electrician for 20 years and it's definitely proven helpful around the house. And he always knows, he's like, fuck it. I can always, you know,
go back
do some electrical work. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, as we've taken this little route to endorsing trade schools, Jason, we would love to hear, you know, as a writer and a parent of two, what is your never thought I'd say this moment?
So mine takes a tiny bit of explanation.
Oh, that's okay. We explain the shit out of things on this show.
My line was, did you vacuum up Maddox Jr.? My son's name is Maddox. He's had long hair his entire life. And long hair on a boy, combing it out, gets the knots in it. Knots all get stuck in the brush. The kid has always had this weird attachment to everything he owns. Everything that's like, he had a fan in his room for years. We just had to throw the fan out 2 days ago. He insisted, he's 11 years old now, he insisted we keep a piece of the fan so he would have something to remember the fan by. It was the same way with the knots we would comb out of his hair. He would want to keep the hair. And he called it Maddox Jr. And he kept it on his desk or his dresser or depending where. And it was missing one day and we had just vacuumed. So I had to ask my wife, did you accidentally vacuum up Maddox Jr.? Because then I would know I'd have to explain to him. We just vacuumed up his imaginary hair friend.
You know,
imaginary hair friend should be a name of a band.
Imaginary hair friend.
Yeah.
Right? It would be a great like 80s hair band.
Wait,
cover
now
band.
I need to know, A, how old was Maddox when this happened? And also, did Maddox Jr. get vacuumed up?
Yeah, like, questions.
So he was probably 4 or 5, I'm guessing, when this happened. And it turns out Maddox Jr. had not been vacuumed up. He had woken up and moved Maddox Jr. from his desk to his nightstand so he could be closer to Maddox Jr.
Right.
It was all good. It was everything turned out okay.
Okay. Maddox Jr. was having some separation anxiety.
Maddox was having separation anxiety from Maddox Jr.
Right. So move closer. Sure.
Question. does Maddox Jr. still exist? And is it like a larger hairball now? Because I just want to, I mean, I also have a child. My 11-year-old gets weirdly attached to things and is a little, I call her my magpie, because if it's like shiny, interesting, could possibly be used to glue to something, it is kept. And I'm like, we're not keeping trash. We're not doing that. But she is also a little collector of things. I'm wondering if Maddox decided to keep.
We do not still have his imaginary hair friend. We have. I'm just now that line landed well. I'm just going to keep.
It may end up being the title of the episode.
No, we just. So. Yeah, we have 10,000 other tiny, weird little things that he's picked up somewhere. And he knows he's like a weird, tiny historian. Like, he knows the history and provenance of every single little thing that he had, like every weird drive-through toy, every like broken piece of something that came out of like a Kinder Surprise egg. And like every single thing. Like, if I were to walk up to his room right now and like grab some and say, where'd this come from? He's like, oh, well, let me explain to you where this came from. And he just goes the whole litany of every, like every, where he got it and what he's used it for and why it's broken. Like, yeah, it'd be like a university class in like the one wheel off a Kinder Surprise truck that he got when he was 7 years old.
That's wow. Amazing.
That is amazing.
And I feel like that's gonna, like at some point in his life, that's gonna be the key to his success, is his ability to like retain the stories of things and present them.
He might be a historian,
right?
Or it's going to be his supervillain origin story, like one of the two.
Right.
Or
he's going to create the largest imaginary hair friend ever and battle Elon Musk for the skies and stars of the world. And that's it could go one of two ways.
And it becomes a national landmark, like a big ball of twine.
That's true.
Imaginary hair friend.
Yeah, charge. And he could tell them the history of each strand of hair that's in it. He's got big things coming. That's all I'm saying.
I think he does. He really does.
But, you know, I love that you shared that story, because these are the things as a parent to someone who doesn't have kids or whatever, or like as you're even growing up and you're like, someday you're going to have a child that keeps a ball of imaginary hair and talks to it and keeps it on their nightstand. And you'd be like, first of all, my kid's not gonna be fucking weird like that, okay? Like, my kid's gonna be fine. They're gonna be cool. They're gonna like have their shit together. And they're not, and then you have kids and you go, oh my God, they're all so strange.
Yeah. They're so strange.
They're so, yeah. And yet fascinating. It's like a weird anthropological experiment in your own home of just watching
these
humans. They're
all weird, fucked up little aliens. Like,
They are weird, fucked up little aliens. It's bizarre. They are. They're like little mini hoarders, or, you know, they grow up to be hoarders like my boyfriend, who also probably has some sort of hair friend somewhere around his house.
I mean, he's got Sherwin.
We can't talk about Sherwin.
We don't talk about Sherwin. Never mind. That's sorry, Dustin.
He doesn't listen. He never even know.
But no, and like, these are the things of parenting that you just kind of go, yeah, this is their weird little quirks. And these are the things that both drive you nuts and you're like, oh my God, why is your room like this? And also are fascinating and so wonderful and endearing about your kids, that like these little moments of life are the things that they're attached to. This one little piece of something means the world to them, and they have an attachment to it. And it's really fun to watch. The next question is, like, how has being a parent influenced your career path? I mean, has this influenced your writing or your life experience? Or for me, when I see my kids do this, I'm like, oh. Like, it opens up my mind to being a little more understanding and compassionate to all sorts of things in the world.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it does. It's like, I wish I could be that guy. I could say, oh, I had these kids and it was such a magical experience and I just had to turn to start writing about them. But it wasn't like that at all. I was a writer, and I was on the phone with my agent one day and we were talking about, like, you know, like what would be a really terrible career path for a writer like me. And it was like, you know who would be bad at writing a children's book? You. Like, you'd be really, really bad. Like, you're the worst guy to, like, ever possibly, like. And I'm like, that sounds like a dare to me. Sort of, it started like that, but it was weird because usually I write really quickly. This one took years to do. I saw my daughter when I was starting this. She was around the age of the characters, around, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. Uh-huh. And now Maddox is just coming into it. So seeing them grow through it absolutely they're in every part of these characters. There'd be no way that I could, I like to think that I have still fairly well in touch with the 14-year-old boy I was. I'm a fucking science fiction writer, for Christ's sake. Of course I'm pretty well in touch with the 14-year-old boy I was. But it's different seeing the actual kids doing this. And you were saying the thing with the stuff that he keeps and these sort of the worlds that he builds with these little tiny memories. There was, when I was writing the book, a big piece of my thinking of it was that kids around that age, right around 12, 13 years old, like not little kids anymore, but not quite tweens yet.
Right.
They have this sort of weird moment in their lives where they exist in this, an imperfect bubble where the things that are right in front of them, the things that are very important to them, their books, their movies, their video games, their friends, their stories, their imaginary hair friends. They form this world and they know that there's a larger world outside this bubble that they live in, but they don't fully interact with it yet. They can avoid it when they choose by focusing on the things that are right in front of them, or they can engage with it just a little. They can like move outside their bubble a little and see, oh, what are mom and dad talking about? What's on the news? What's outside my neighborhood? What's past my street? Like this stuff, but it's not their world yet. Their world is right. Still this sort of small, somewhat protected universe that they live in. Mm-hmm. And I found that really fascinating. And I got really weird and pedantic about it with literally every single human being that I knew or stranger I ran into on the street for like 2 or 3 years talking about this and trying to see if people could remember that from when they were that age as well. Like, yeah. What did you remember from the world when you were 12, when you were 13? I mean, most people, like, you're lucky if you walk away with like 2 or 3 memories from that time, like 2 or 3 big world events happening that sort of shape the way you see the whole world outside as you're coming out into it. So it absolutely, watching them go through this, and particularly watching them go through it in the middle of, you know, a global pandemic and all the other bullshit we're going through.
Right.
Like, yeah, it was fascinating.
I mean, we've been talking about the book is called Children of the Flying City, and it's an amazingly thrilling read for parents and kids. I want to read a little bit of the back of the book blurb because it's fascinating. So brought, here it is. This is on the back of the book. Brought to the flying city of Highgate when he was only 5 years old, orphan Milo Quick has never known another home. Now almost 13, Milo survives one daredevil grift at a time, relying only on his wit, speed, and best friends, Jules and Dagda. A massive armada has surrounded Highgate's crumbling armaments. Because behind locked doors, in opulent parlors and pneumatic forests, and a master toymaker's workshop, the once great flying city protects a powerful secret hidden away for centuries, a secret that's about to ignite a war. One small airship, the Halcyon, has slipped through the ominous blockade on a mission to collect Milo and the rich bounty on his head before the fighting begins. But the members of the Halcyon's misfit crew aren't the only ones chasing Milo Quick. Ooh!
Yeah.
Sounds I love this.
Also, I'm so glad that you read that because I'm so dyslexic and I'm like, there's no, I wouldn't have gotten half of those words right. They would have come out completely backwards.
I will say, like, even the back of the book and the blurb, like, you use such fantastic, I mean, as a writer, obviously you do, but I love when writers write a book aimed towards kids, but they don't write it like the kids are idiots.
Yeah.
They write it towards kids who are smart and intelligent. And like,
if you have to look up a word, you look up a word.
I still look that up. There are words that I've read over and over again. And I'm like, you know what? I don't actually think I know what this means.
I do it all the time.
I need to look it up.
Yep.
And I remember doing that as a kid. So I love that attitude towards young adult literature, which is that you are ready to learn new things and expand. And, you know, you're a smart individual when we're going to treat you that way. Yeah. Here's a journey of a book that's going to have interesting, like, mature concepts to it that you're going to have to figure out as a young adult. I really respect that as a writer. So thank you for doing that. My kids, I just took them to Barnes and Noble the other day, and my youngest is very into manga.
Yeah.
Is that how you say it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very into that. Both my girls really love to read. And they went and bought like 6 or 7 books. And I am never prouder than when I'm in the bookstore and like me and my 2 girls walk up with like a shit ton of books. And I'm like, yep, we read. Yep. We read like real
my
books,
kids don't
like
play video games. They read. Same here. I just ordered my kids a mouse because, you know, fuck you, I'm going to order the mouse so they can read that. I'm so excited for them to read
I was like, right. A mouse? Did you order a mouse off the internet? Mouse. Like, just a, got it.
Yeah.
Mouse, M-A-U-S, yes, mouse.
Where did the idea for this book come from?
That's one of those questions. It's usually such an easy answer because it's usually like, oh, you know, I was walking down the street and blah, 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 blah. This one was weird. This one didn't come from anywhere in particular. A lot of the writing I do, particularly the books I do, is motivated by spite and anger. And like, you tell me what I can't do.
Yeah.
So like a big part of it was that idea of I wanted to write a book for kids that didn't treat them like tiny morons, that wasn't just happy, glossy, shiny, simple. Yeah. One of my original pitches for the book to my agent, not to any of the publishers, was it's going to be like Blood Meridian, but for kids. Cormac McCarthy, but for kids.
I mean, right.
And weirdly, I would say like one of the bigger inspirations for the book was the first chapter of Blood Meridian, which is sort of runs down this in a few hundred words. He gives an entire history of this young boy's life up until he is the absolute psychotic that we know at the beginning of the book. And I'm like, man, if you could take that and you could distill, number one, stretch it out into a whole book, but distill it down to just a couple days in someone's life where this is what shaped them, this is what formed them, that would make for a really interesting book. And I think it would make for a really interesting book for kids because they're the ones who are going to have to do that. They're going to have those days. They're going to have those moments. They're going to have those experiences that are going to form them. As weird and sideways of a journey as that was sort of the idea for it. I wanted something that took place over a short amount of time, was kids at a very specific age. And then everything, like I said, everything else was my 14-year-old. It was flying cities and airships and mysteries and, you know, creepy pirates and like all the stuff that I love, like stuff that everything that I want, that I would have wanted to find in a book when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. I just crammed it all into this one and figured it would all work out in the end.
I love that.
I do too.
That's so, what a great idea for a book because it comes from a place of, like I said, genuinely treating kids like, look, these are the things that are going to happen. You're going to have short periods of time in your life that are going to change who you are, how you think, what you want. And we all have had those moments. And, you know, I mean, yes, you have them all throughout your life. But like in high school and that early prepubescent, pubescent period, like those are the things. Yeah. Those are the like, they're mind-blowing moments. And we need to, you know, and I think sometimes we forget that. And we think that kids, you know, that their problems are like so trivial or they're like, oh my God, get over it or this or that. Like these are life forming events in many ways.
And they're not. Even the things that from the outside can seem so trivial, can seem small. You never know what the thing is going to be. You never know what is going to be that moment that's going to define some aspect of you going forward. Yeah. You know, you never know which fish hook is going to stick in there.
You said that you started writing it, like it took a really long time. So I assume that you started writing it pre-pandemic.
Very pre-pandemic.
And this is your first book for young readers. And then there was, you know, a review that described it as brutal and sweet and ambitious story of survival and loyalty. That was by Publishers Weekly. So did you have to change, like, did things change because of the pandemic? Did you start out thinking it was going to be one thing? And then did the pandemic end up influencing you?
No, it didn't really. I was into final edits during the pandemic. So I had sold the thing pre-pandemic. Then, you know, publishing is slow. It's a very slow process, very slow industry. So the pandemic happened in what should have been like our sort of run up to like, okay, now we're doing pages, now we're doing copy editing. It delayed everything. So
as it did, you know,
as it did for everybody, everywhere with everything. But the sequel, because I sold two of them and I'm hoping there's going to be three. The sequel was written. I should be entirely done with it. I'm not. The half to three quarters of it, in case my publisher is listening, that I have finished done and absolutely beautiful, were all written during the pandemic. That's its own weird thing. And it's funny because like I hadn't thought that what I was writing was terribly influenced by the pandemic until I realized that a huge portion of what I have down on the page already takes place with all of the characters trapped inside two very small airships that they can't leave. And I'm like, well, that makes sense. I spent 2 years sitting in one, you know, very small house with my wife and two kids that we couldn't leave. So yeah, and I hadn't really thought that that was where that came from, but I'm pretty sure that's where that came from.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And even if it wasn't, like, you all of a sudden have a new perspective to be able to write about something like that, because you're like, oh, I can understand this a little bit more. I've been trapped in a small space.
Man, I wrote an entire chapter where he just walks in circles around one room for 8 solid hours not talking to anybody. Where'd that come from? That's weird. Man, I don't know who would do something like that. Yeah.
I think I did that yesterday, but you know.
And in the book, you know, you spend a lot of time warning the reader that things might not turn out well, which is my kind of book, by the way. Like, I don't like things to be neatly wrapped up. I want life. Life happens and it's messy and it's ugly and sometimes it doesn't turn out great. And sometimes, you know, I mean, I've read so many books where, oh my God, you lose the favorite character. And it's heartbreaking or, you know, something happens and you're like, this is the journey I want to go on in a book.
Well, we have to warn our kids of that also. I mean, like, but yeah, not to be a pessimist.
I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's so great for kids to learn that. Yeah. Like, sometimes things don't go the way that you thought they were. Sometimes things go kind of shitty.
Right. Yeah.
And you're going to have to walk.
Sometimes Old Yeller
that.
Gets, you know, shot.
Don't bring up the dog.
But it is that, you know, it's always why I really liked Stephen King books for that reason, was that he always was just, you know, unapologetic about the fact that not everyone was going to make it, like you said, you know.
Right. And so based on those sorts of warnings and things like that, what is the youngest age you would recommend for this book? I know the publisher says, I think 10 and up. I guess it would depend on the 10-year-old, but, you know, it's pretty dark and gritty. So do you think that maybe like a more of a middle school audience, although I guess, you know, again, it depends on the 10-year-old. At 10, I probably would have read this and been like totally understanding of it and whatever.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's it. It's one of the reasons that those warnings are in there. One of the reasons why this has a sort of a narrator character who's telling the story is for exactly that reason, because you don't know, you know, whose hands this is going to end up with. I don't think anybody can tell a kid of that age what they're ready for better than the kid can themselves. So they know.
Yeah.
They know what they can take. And what they don't want to see could be something that to me was just nothing. Like, that's a sentence I just dashed off about them. But that could be the thing. And then they take the book, they close it, they put it aside. Maybe they find it again later. Maybe they need a week. Right. Maybe they need a year before they're ready for that thing. So in the big moments, when things are really taking a turn, there's 2 or 3 points in the book where it goes from, okay, the story was one thing, and now it's very much something else. And then it's that for a while. And then it's really, really, really something else. And the narrator comes in. And the voice actually gets an entire small chapter at a certain part saying, like, look, you've gotten this far. Not everything has been great, but it hasn't all been terrible either. Like, we've had some fun. We've had some laughs. It's been good. After this, though, everything is about loss. Everything before this was about learning stuff. Everything after is about loss. And that's sad, and that sucks. And if you want to stop now and make up your own story that everybody lives happily ever after, that's cool. Milo, Jules, Dogda, they're not going to care. Yeah. they don't mind if you finish their story for them. Mm-hmm. You might be happier. Your parents will certainly be happier. If you want to put it away, cool, put it away. Now, granted, I'm also talking to a kid like me who, if I had read a chapter like that, I
would read this. You're like, I'm going to read it.
I would have put that book down. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But it's fair to warn whoever's come to that point to say, like, look, things get a little rough at this point. Things get explodey and stabby. So
it was like the people that warned you of the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones that were like, look, just hold the fuck on when you watch this episode. Okay. Like, you don't have to watch it if you don't want it. Like, I'm just telling you, shit gets real. You know what I mean? Like, that was, and you were like, okay. Yeah. I know this going in now. Like, I know. And then it happens. You're like, oh my God, everyone's dead.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you're like, holy fuck, that just happened. But the show went on for several more seasons. So, you know,
that's crazier.
The thing, right? That's the thing, right? Is you just kind of know, like, okay, like, again, life isn't pretty. It's messy. Sometimes the heroes of your story get cut short. Sometimes things happen. But I love that you incorporated sort of the narrator's voice into that. And we're like, here's the deal. Like, you've made it this far. You can keep going. You are capable of making a choice, and making a choice that might change you after you read this. And I, again, find that to be so highly respectful of young readers, to really engage with them and like let them know that this is important. It's important that you read things that challenge you. I always tell my kids, like, read something that, and I personally, I love to read things that make me a little uncomfortable.
Me too.
I like to watch like my type of movie. The reason I'm not a huge rom-com fan is I'm like, right, this is so fucking unrealistic, even though, you know, gotta love a Hallmark movie or a, you know, whatever, or Lifetime, all that stuff. But for me, watching them, like, I want to watch something that challenges me, that makes me go, oh my God, I didn't think about it that
like
way.
Midsommar, when we watched that.
Oh my God, like, Midsommar. Yeah, I mean, look, if somebody invites me to a lovely fucking outdoor, you know, sort of Swedish looking festival and there's a bear suit there, I'm telling you right now, I'm getting the hell out of there. That's it. Somebody says, like, you're going to be the summer queen in Midsommar. I'll be like, fuck you. No, I'm not.
I told this story in one of the other interviews. I had an English teacher in high school, I think, who told me once that the reason that we still read Shakespeare is that Shakespeare defined the outer boundaries of human experience. Mm. Like, no one is going to suffer like Hamlet. No one is going to be crazy like Macbeth. No one else is going to love like Romeo and Juliet. The reason that we read it is to have a point of comparison for the most extreme of everything.
Right.
Now, right, being the kid I was in high school, my first reaction was, fuck you, I can do better than that. Like, I can make it more extreme. As I've mellowed a little, I get that. I get what he was trying to say, which was that you read these things so that some respect, so you can see it coming. If you look in the mirror and you see Lady Macbeth, you know, just a couple steps behind you, like, oh, right, you've gone too far.
I just recently watched the new Macbeth with Frances McDormand and Denzel. Yeah. One of my best friends was a script supervisor on it, Emma. And I watched that movie and, I love the story of Macbeth, but it was so deeply relatable. And they brought it to life in such a way that you so understood it. You know, like you said, it's one of the things that I do love about Shakespeare is like you read it and you go, oh my God, I get that. I get that teenage, like, I'll die before I ever leave you. Understandable human emotion. And you read it and then you're like, oh my God, but this really ends shitty for everyone. Like, you know what I mean? And you're like, ooh, that can't be good. But man, do I understand that, you know, the want for power or the ego or whatever it is, like, we relate to it, and it's to watch the tragedy play out. You're like, oh, okay, yeah, so that's not a good idea to do. Okay, got it.
It hits completely differently at the age that you're reading it too, which
is
like they have kids read Romeo and Juliet in high school, which is on the one hand, absolutely bonkers. This is a bloody, murdery, horrible, terrible.
Right. It's gang violence and two young people kill themselves over someone that they've met for like moments.
Which is also why it is so brilliant to have them read it at that age.
I thought about that a lot with a case that they actually have a movie about it now with Elle Fanning in it.
Oh, the girl from Plainville?
Yes, the girl from Plainville. Right. Like that to me was, that whole case I remember thinking was Romeo and Juliet, except Juliet backed out of the deal. But people do, you know, kids do it, and it's so much more, you know, accessible for kids to do it now because of text messaging, like that entire case. And if people who don't know what we're talking about right now, there was a case where, you know, she was actually, I think she was convicted. It was homicide, I believe.
Basically she pushed him into, right, and it was a whole thing.
Yeah, but, and she was convicted of it. But, you know, to your point about Shakespeare, like those stories do present over and over and over again, and we have different protagonists, and it does hit you differently. Right. Same with when kids can read this, like we, you know, what they take away from stories is not what we're going to take away from a story. And I love that you wrote a book that, you know, I feel like I can go and read this and also have my kids read it.
Yeah.
And they're at such different ages, my 10, my 15-year-old, and we all can talk about it, and we're all going to have a different experience of the book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, speaking of kids, have your kids read the book and have they critiqued it? Oh, because God. I know my kids often will be like, why would I want to watch something you're in? You're like, lame, mom. Like, they don't, it's not an exciting thing. They're like, whatever. I've just been hearing about this shit for a long time, you know? But sometimes kids are super into reading what their parents do, and they are so excited to be able to give their opinion.
Excited to give their opinions? Yes. Excited to read the entire book? Absolutely not. Right. They would never.
Ew, Dad. And if they liked it, they'd never. They'd be like, that makes me feel better. It was fine.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie, Jason. I actually kind of feel good about that. Like I'm like, oh, good. It happens to all parents, no matter how cool. Like, we're like, this is the coolest thing that you wrote this. But cool, your kids too?
My first book was a memoir, which I ridiculously wrote when I was like 29, 30. Everything about my past, everything about their mother and my's relationship, how we met, how we got together, all the dumb shit that we did. The book is sitting right there. There's copies all over our damn house. Neither one of them have ever thought to pick it up.
Well, thank God.
Well, there you go.
Like, in a way, like thank God. Absolutely. Right. But also, like really, dudes? Like, really? Your mother and I are that uninteresting to you?
Yeah, because you didn't have a life before then. I remember thinking that as a kid, where you're like, nothing exciting happened in your life until I arrived. You know what I mean?
Right.
Obviously. Like, right. What the fuck were you doing in your 20s? Nothing cool, because I'm 14 now. Right. And
look at you
awesome now.
You're definitely not cool now. Right. So you couldn't ever have been cool.
Yeah. And that's the instinct. I think it's the instinct with this too. My daughter, the 18-year-old, I had her read specific passages, specific sections, because her critiques are the absolute most brutal thing. It's not just like, oh, this is, you know, this is boring or this is that. It's just like she'll read a particular line and just cock one eyebrow in a way that just absolutely murders me on the spot. Right. Like, oh, that one. Okay, that one was okay. I'll go back and fix that.
Right.
And I had my boy read other sections of it because he's sort of the target age for the younger side of reading it. Like, you know, I had him read the beginning, like, hey, can you get into this? This is cool. And he'll like go and he'll read, you know, like a couple pages and then start slowing up. And then it's like a paragraph in 15 minutes. And then just like wait till I'm not looking, put the book aside. I'm like, okay, cool. Like that's where you lost interest. Let's see what happened there. And like, did it get boring there? And he's like, no, I just wanted to do something else. Like, oh, but yeah, so they've both read the book in bits and pieces on request and under duress.
Right. So their opinions, you know, are like,
could you actually make this a picture book, Dad? Right. That would be like, great. A
basically
board book.
Shoving bamboo under their fingernails. Right. And you're like, yeah, you know, and waiting for them to critique the book. And they're like, yeah, it's great. Just please stop doing that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this is obviously the first book in what appears to be a series. So what else, if anything, can you tell us about Milo's future adventures in Children of the Flying City?
It doesn't get easier. The first book takes place over 3 days. It's the first 3 days of summer in Highgate. It takes place at the very, very, very beginning of a war. The end of the book is the beginning of the war. The start of the second book is literally 5 minutes later. It is everything that happens after the war has started to those who are desperately trying to flee that war and get somewhere else.
Wow. Well, I feel like that's probably an incredibly relevant story to tell. I mean, obviously that happens and has happened all over the world for young people and is happening.
Yeah, which was a really weird and unbelievably tragic coincidence to be able to see scenes that I had written a couple years ago showing up on my TV.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I think about that all the time when I've seen, you know, images in Syria or Afghanistan or, you know, now Ukraine. Can only imagine how war affects young people and but also reading a story about it where you go, you know what, this is the reality of life and this is what happens, and relaying that to young people I think is so important and just such a great story to tell. Jason, I have loved having you on the show. I'm really excited to read the book and I'm really excited to get my kids to read the book. I think they will really, really like it. So again, it's called Children of the Flying City by Jason Sheehan. Please go out and get your copy. Go out and read this. We highly recommend this book. And Jason, it has been a pleasure having you on the show and talking all things Imaginary Hair Friends.
Imaginary Hair Friends. See, you had to get that in one more time. It's been a blast.
I mean, that's an important topic that really gets glossed over often. my dog also has imaginary hair friends that blow through the wood floor on this house. So
I got to be honest, every time I take a shower, because I have really, obviously really curly hair, I, you know, lose chunks of it. And now I'm sort of like, how much should I just save them? And we'll see. Like, I could just send them back to Maddox if you want. And we'll just see if he like remembers.
I will let him know there's other people out there collecting.
There's other people out there.
I'll document it. Like, this. Yeah. I'll give it its own social media. Just call it Imaginary Hair Friend. We'll see. Like,
perfect.
You know, how many followers it gets.
Perfect. I love it. Yeah. It'll get millions of views. Yeah. Far more than our podcast.
Than we do. Yeah.
anyway, Jason, where can people find you? Speaking of social media, where can they find you and check out more of your writing, more of your books, and all things about Children of the Flying City?
They can find me on Twitter, Jason_Sheehan. They can find the book where ever, wherever fine books are sold. Also at the Penguin Random House site. And I believe there is a Facebook page for people who have read the book, survived the book, want to talk about the book a little bit.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us today. If you are listening to the podcast and you want to find us on social media, you can check out at Never Thought I'd Say This. Mm-hmm. You can also follow me at Jody Sweeten across socials. Where do they find you?
They will find me at The Celia Behar on whatever socials I know how to use. I also want to thank our mutual friend, Jason Andrew, who sent me a late night PM one night and said, you have to meet Jason.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely right. So thank you, Andrew, for that. Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. And here is to reading and fellow book nerds like myself out there. I've always had a love for reading. So I'm so excited to have amazing young people's authors on here. It's great.
Yeah.
So anyway, you guys, thank you for tuning in today. And remember, keep killing the parenting game.
And not your kids.
Or your imaginary hair friends.
Never Thought I'd Say This with Jody Sweeten and Celia Behar is an Audio Boom original.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.